Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Bowles, and good afternoon to you all. I thought the first hymn that we sang today was very appropriate to what I'm going to speak about today. And I suppose that the story I'm going to relate to you has part of its origins in the early months of 1942. Hitler's Economic Bureau had formulated a plan for a German-led Europe. That plan was entitled Europäische Wirtschaft Gemeinschaft, which roughly translates into the English phrase, the European Economic Community. However, we are led to believe that this plan was never put into operation because Nazi Germany was, quote, defeated. But by August of 1944, many high-ranking German officials, particularly in the Nazi Party, realised that there was no possibility of Germany winning the Second World War. As a result, a high-level conference comprising the German High Command, senior Nazi Party officials, and a large contingent of the German industry and commerce was convened at the Hotel Rootshaus in Strasbourg. At that meeting, it was proposed that large amounts of Germany's gold and currency reserves should be exported and used by the subsidiaries of the German industries and financial institutions in countries that were not antagonistic to Germany's objectives. The immediate result of that conference being that some $500 million value of gold was placed at the disposal of the industrialists, and the most prominent Nazi officials then went underground. There were, however, strings attached to these funds. One of the most important being that the Nazi officials would be taken onto the employment records of the industrialists benefiting from this plan as research and development experts. The prime obligation being that when the Nazi Party came out of hibernation, those who had benefited in 1944 would then fund the Nazi machine. The Office of Strategic Studies, the OSS, had an agent present at that meeting, the details of which were released in 1996 by the US State Department, and a copy of that report of that meeting appeared in the New York Times shortly after that particular report and other documents had been declassified. That's over 40 years after the end of the war. After the Second World War ended in 1945, political leaders throughout Western Europe began to seek a means of securing the future peace of Europe. Despite the fact that Europe had become divided by the ideologies of the various victors, namely the capitalist Anglo-Saxon Gaelic nations and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The effect of that initial search was the European Coal and Steel Community, and that was established between six Western European nations, and that in turn led to the establishment of the European Economic Community in 1952. It is from this latter institution, inaugurated by the Treaty of Rome, that Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, Holland and Luxembourg bound themselves together in what was believed to be an economic partnership. Unfortunately, such was not really the case. This is because the Treaty of Rome contains an underlying clause that states that the objective is for full political integration as the ultimate aim of the community. Is it a fair question to ask? Am I saying that the project is a Nazi plan for world domination? I'm certainly not dismissing that possibility, because Mr. Armstrong made the following quotation on the 9th of May 1945. He said, "We don't understand German thoroughness. From the very start of World War II, they have considered the possibility of losing this second round as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned, in such an eventuality, the third round, World War III. Hitler has lost. This round of the war in Europe is over, and the Nazis have now gone underground in capitals. In France and Norway, they learned how effectively an organized underground can hamper occupation and control of a country.
Paris was liberated by the French underground and Allied armies. Now a Nazi underground is methodically planned. They plan to come back and to win at the third try. The Bible foretells that the third round, and it spells doom for us as God's punishment, because we, as a nation, have forsaken him and his ways. The third round is termed, in prophecy, an invasion by Babylon, a resurrected Roman Empire, a European Union. And Mr. Armstrong goes on to say, I have been proclaiming that since 1927, and as I said before, he said this on the 9th of May 1945, and this can be found on pages 114 to 116 of the autobiography. Following the rejection of the proposed EU constitution by the electorate of France and Holland, I felt there was an opportune moment to update us on the European Union project. This is because the voice of the people, which is generally antagonistic to the views of the ruling EU elite, could trigger the emergence of the prophesied seventh resurrection of the, quote, holy, unquote, Roman Empire. There is something just beneath the surface, even now, that could be woken up from its slumbers and to lurch centre stage onto world affairs. At the moment, there does not seem to be anything tangible to allow us to say with any degree of certainty what the shape of the coming European power will be. However, it is being created. Whatever is being created behind a figurative screen of smoke and mirrors. In the current politics of the European project, we find no shortage of lies, deception, the hiding of or the ridiculing of the truth. Now I'd like you to turn with me, please, to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 2. Here we see Daniel was standing on the shore of the sea when a number of creatures emerged from the sea. The creatures had not been visible prior to that time, and at the same time, it is a similar way with a current coming European power. Nothing is exactly visible as we would expect to see it. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 2 reads as follows. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my visions by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, diverse one from another. And then dropping down to verses 7 and 8. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, and it devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. One of the architects of what is believed, or what is perceived as the European Union, is Jean Monnet, who is reputed to be responsible for the following statement. Quote, Europe's nations should be guided towards a superstate without their people understanding what is happening. This can be accomplished by successive steps, each disguised as having an economic purpose, but which will eventually and irreversibly lead to federation. So far, I have only been able to find these words attributed to Mr. Monnet when Adrian Hilton refers to a communique the 30th of April 1952 on page 84 of his book, The Principality and the Power of Europe. Certainly nothing in the present attitude of the senior members of the political elites of the European Union would give us any reason to doubt that these words are their modus operandi. According to the EU Observer of the 31st of May this year, all the leaders of the states comprising the European Union, only one, I believe it's Václav Havel, certainly it's the President of the Czech Republic, has called for the constitution to be scrapped following the rejection by France and Holland. The EU Commissioner for Trade, Mr. Peter Mandelson, is reported as saying, quote, no single member has a veto over a constitutional treaty of this sort. And that was quoted from the Daily Mail of the 31st of May, again this year. Far more accurate is the analysis given by Jean-Claude Juncker, who is a Prime Minister of Luxembourg and currently holds the title of EU President. He quotes, he says, and I quote, if it is a yes, we carry on. If it is a no, we carry on, unquote. There you have it, as neat a statement of the EU's guiding philosophy as you could ask for. The project is far too important to be denied by the ballot box, and that appears in the Daily Telegraph of the 30th of May. Then there is this statement. Any country voting no to the Constitution, according to President Chirac, must leave the EU. He may not wish to be reminded of that today, but this is what he told journalists in Paris on the 28th of April 2004, and that was reported in the Sunday Telegraph, again the 29th of May 2005. The same source also reports that he said to the Financial Times 2 days earlier, that is the 30th of April 2004, it is a matter of ratify or quit. But now it seems that the French are expected to vote again until they have to come to the right answer. Having said all this, it is widely reported that the proposed EU constitution will be implemented piecemeal. For example, on the 31st of May, the EU Observer reports that Javier Solana, who is the current EU Foreign Ministry spokesman, has been prepared to, quote, urge the bloc's leaders to proceed with plans to create the Union's diplomatic service despite the French rejection of the Constitution, the document in which it is enshrined. And that is the end of that quote. Also, quoting from the Sunday Telegraph of the 29th of May 2005, however, most of the contents of the Constitution will be rammed through using existing treaty structures. Indeed, as a Tory MEP Daniel Hannan pointed out in these pages last week, this process has already begun. The harmonisation of criminal justice, the judicial assimilation of the Charter of the Fundamental Rights, the creation of the European Foreign Service, these are already underway, even though most member states have yet to ratify the constitution that authorises them. As I say, that is from the Daily Telegraph of the 29th of May. In addition to the member states of the European Union, the EU Observer of the 13th of May 2005 reports that the Catholic Church has officially endorsed the EU constitution, but concerns among some groups on its possible implications for future decisions on such issues as abortion, euthanasia or women priests remains a problem. I would like you to turn with me now to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 1. This time it is John who is having the vision, and he is also standing on the seashore. But here there is a remarkable similarity between the two visions. Both men are speaking about the same subject, an empire that has several resurrections, and that is controlled by a small horn speaking great things. Revelation chapter 13, verse 1 reads as follows. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast come up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded unto death, and the deathly wound was healed. And the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Perhaps this explains, at least in part, why the Roman Catholic Church should endorse this undemocratic and dictatorial constitution. Power is there for the taking. I would like to revert to Mr. Armstrong's words once more from page 115 of the autobiography, the second volume. The Nazi underground will introduce a new kind of internal war and sabotage to divide and conquer. It will stir race hatred, class prejudice, strife among nations, religious bigotry whilst professing to champion religious tolerance, especially towards religion of the coming United States of Europe. The commissioners of the European Union are prepared to ride roughshod over the nations of the European Union, and not only the nations, but also the will of the people as well. As I've already said, something is stirring just below the surface. The rejection of the proposed European Union's constitution could provide just the impetus to propel the coming beast power into the open. The reason for saying this is because two reports in recent days have been highly critical of the future of the euro, that is, the currency of the European Union. The first of these was reported in the Daily Telegraph on the 2nd of June, whose headline was, Euro falls after, and then I put in brackets, Stern magazine airs Berlin secret doubts. This has been followed by a swift denial from official sources in Berlin. Even so, the euro fell to US dollars 122.030. The euro plunged to an 8-month low yesterday after Germany's Stern magazine reported that top German officials had examined the possible collapse of the single currency at a secret meeting in Berlin. Traders were also on edge following that report, and in an unprecedented attack on monetary union from a major German magazine, Stern said it was time to break the taboo by admitting that Germany had been gravely damaged by giving up the Deutschmark 6 years ago. Entitled Der Euro macht uns kaputt, the euro is destroying us, the article called Monetary Union, quote, one of the worst economic blunders made by Germany since 1945, and some 56% of Germans are now calling for the reintroduction of the German mark. Also, according to EU Observer on the 2nd of June, these reports were swiftly denied by German sources. And according to the Financial Times of the 20th of December 2004, Germany has 3,400 tons of gold. At the same time, Germany is not the only European country to maintain very high levels of gold reserves. France has a little over 2,500 tons. Italy a little under... Sorry, France a little under 3,000 tons. Italy a little under 2,500 tons. The Netherlands slightly more than 750 tons. And the EC Bank also has about that same figure. So we see that if the euro does collapse, there is gold in certain European countries to avoid a complete meltdown. However, the Times of the 2nd of June states that Stuart Thompson of Sutherland's, the brokerage firm, said in a research note that the euro's demise was, quote, inevitable by 2020, likely by 2008. Something may be about to give. I know that it may sound as if I'm prepared to see a Nazi under every bed, but we need to remember that both Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler were socialists. Stalin was a communist socialist, while Hitler was a national socialist. And Hitler despised the Soviet approach of state ownership. His idea was that you assist private individuals to run industries by grants, by aid, and by subsidies. Thus, we find that in the EU today, and in Britain, we find two particular economic arms used to forward this. One is the private financial initiative, where money is raised on the money markets to fund government-sponsored projects, and the other one is a public-private partnership, whereby government-owned projects are funded by the private industry upkeeping them. And in both instances, the entrepreneurs involved are virtually gold-plated from any problems that may ensue. There's hardly any possibility of them suffering any financial loss of any form whatsoever. And if we turn now to Revelation chapter 18, and beginning in verse 11, we see how it is that the it's not the kings and princes who are particularly worried by the demise of the European Union. It is, in fact, the merchants. And in beginning of verse 11, read the following. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys her merchandise anymore. And we read a whole list of the merchandise, and it goes down, and it finishes up, and slaves, and the bodies of men. Now, it's pretty grim. And we have seen during the last few days, the birth pains are something far more odious than the European that had become a superstate by virtue of a new constitution. The overriding, the underlying features of the government of the European project is one of coercion, of deception, of deceit, and of threats. The unelected, unaccountable officials, the Commission and its bureaucracy, are aiming for power, total power. They will not be put off by the will of the people. Now, I'd like to turn back now to Matthew chapter 25, verse 13. Whilst we're turning, I'd like you to consider the words of Jean-Henri Spaak, a former Prime Minister of Belgium, who was prominent in the early days of this particular European project. And I quote, "The most effective way to disguise their project's political purpose was to conceal it behind a pretense that it was concerned only with economic cooperation based on dismantling trade barriers, a common market." And so if we read Matthew chapter 25, verse 13, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man comes." Now, that is important because this coming European Union has to come before Jesus Christ returns. And this whole gamut of the European project must come first because it is the rod of God's correction upon a disobedient people that have turned their backs on God.